Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. The answer to the question, what do Denmark, Costa Rica, and Singapore have in common? Is happiness. They are the most joyful countries in the world. I guess you would call today's article a sociological look at happiness. I found it thought-provoking and interesting that all of these countries provide a social safety net and acknowledge that health is a factor of happiness. And this is from National Geographic, their November 2017 issue and written by Dan Buettner. Who is the world's happiest person? It may be Alejandro Zuniga, a healthy middle-aged father who socializes at least 6 hours a day and has a few good friends he can count on. He sleeps at least 7 hours most nights, walks to work, and eats 6 servings of fruits and vegetables most days. He works no more than 40 hours a week at a job he loves with co-workers he enjoys. He spends a few hours every week volunteering. On the weekends, he worships God and indulges his passion for soccer. In short, he makes daily choices that favor happiness, choices made easier because he lives among like-minded people in the verdant, temperate Central Valley of Costa Rica. Sidsey Clemenson is another possible candidate. With a loving partner and 3 young children, she lives in a tightly knit co-housing community with other families who share chores, childcare, and meals in a communal kitchen. She's a sociologist, a job that challenges and engages her every day. She and her family bicycle to work, the store, and the children's school, which helps keep them fit. She pays high taxes on her modest salary, but gets health care and education for her family, as well as guaranteed retirement income. In Aalborg, Denmark, where she lives, people feel confident the government will make sure that nothing too bad happens to them. And then there is Douglas Foo, a successful entrepreneur. He drives a $750,000 BMW and lives in a $10 million house. He's married with 4 well-behaved children who excel at school. He put himself through school working 4 jobs and started a company that eventually grew into a $59 million multinational enterprise. He works about 60 hours a week between his business and his philanthropic pursuits. He's earned the respect of his employees, peers, and the larger community. He's worked hard to achieve his success, but as Foo readily admits, he probably couldn't have created this life anywhere other than Singapore. Zuniga, Clemenson, and Foo illustrate 3 different strands of happiness that braid together in complementary ways to create lasting joy. I call them pleasure, purpose, and pride. They also live in countries that encourage these strands. By meeting each of these people and exploring their home countries, we'll discover the secrets to what makes the people in these places so much happier than those in other places. Consider Zuniga, who, like many Costa Ricans, enjoys the pleasure of living daily life to the fullest in a place that mitigates stress and maximizes joy. Scientists call his type of happiness experienced happiness or positive affect. Surveys measure it by asking people how often they smiled, laughed, or felt joy during the past 24 hours. His country is not only Latin America's happiest, it's also where people report feeling more day-to-day positive emotions than just about any other place in the world. Clemenson represents a brand of happiness typified in the purpose-driven life of Danes. Like all forms of happiness, it assumes basic needs are covered so that people can pursue their passions at work and leisure. Academics refer to this as eudaimonic happiness, a term that comes from the ancient Greek word for happy. The concept was made popular by Aristotle, who believed that true happiness came only from a life of meaning, of doing what was worth doing. Gallup measures this by asking respondents whether they learned or did something interesting yesterday. In Denmark, a country that has most consistently topped Europe's happiness rankings for the past 40 years, society has evolved to make it easy to live an interesting life. And true to Singapore's reputation for having a semi-fanatical drive for success, Fu, with all his ambition and accomplishments, represents the life satisfaction strand of happiness. Social scientists often measure this type of happiness by asking people to rate their lives on a scale of 0 to 10. Experts call this evaluative happiness. Internationally, it's considered the gold standard metric of well-being. Singapore has most dependably ranked number one in Asia for life satisfaction. The researchers who published the annual World Happiness Report found that about three-quarters of human happiness is driven by six factors: strong economic growth, healthy life expectancy, quality social relationships, generosity, trust, and freedom to live the life that's right for you. These factors don't materialize by chance. They are intimately related to a country's government and its cultural values. In other words, the happiest places incubate happiness for their people. To illustrate the power of place, John Helliwell, one of the report's editors, analyzed 500,000 surveys completed by immigrants who'd moved to Canada from 100 countries over the previous 40 years, many from countries considerably less happy. Remarkably, Helliwell and his colleagues discovered that within a few years of arriving, immigrants who came from unhappy places began to report the increased happiness level of their adoptive home. Seemingly, their environment alone accounted for their increased happiness. Zuniga, Clemenson, and Fu pursue their goals intensely, but not at the expense of joy and laughter, and they look with pride on what they are doing and what they have already accomplished. They're able to do this in many cases because the places where they live, their nations, communities, neighborhoods, and family households, give them an invisible lift, constantly nudging them into behaviors that favor long-term well-being. Let's return to Alejandro Zuniga, who works as a produce vendor at the Central Market in Cartago, a city just east of San Jose, Costa Rica's capital. For decades, the husky 57-year-old has been a fixture at the market, showing up day after day to sell avocados, socialize, and try out new jokes. Everyone there knows him. Whenever any of the five dozen or so other vendors falls ill or has a family emergency, it's usually Zuniga who takes up a collection to help. He organizes weekend trips to cheer on the city's beloved but often hapless soccer team, CS Cartagines. He's a charismatic friend and a natural leader. One night a few years ago, Zuniga got a call from a friend with exciting news. "You've won the lottery," he shouted. Zuniga had bought the winning ticket and was about to receive 50 million colones, then about $93,000. But Zuniga didn't believe his friend, a well-known practical joker. Besides, he wasn't in the mood. It had been a long day, and he hadn't sold all of his avocados. "I thought it was an ugly joke," he recalled. "I was down to my last $8. He hung up on his friend. When Zuniga showed up for work the next day, the vendors erupted in applause. News of his winning had spread. Each week, he bet on the same number. This time, his number had come up. Giddy, Zuniga strode past the produce stalls with an alpha male's long-armed lope and high-fived his friends and colleagues. They knew that Zuniga had never had it easy. He'd grown up in shanty towns, quit school at 12 to earn a living, struggled with alcohol, and lost the love of his life at age 20 when she left him. Now that he'd struck it rich, his fellow vendors assumed they'd lose him to a new, more affluent life. But in the weeks after his win, Zuniga surprised his friends by returning to the market, hawking his produce and playing practical jokes. Quietly, though, he was giving away his fortune, 1 million colones to the friend who'd sold him the lottery ticket, 1 million to a food stall owner who'd fed him in lean times, and 1 million to a market beggar he knew. The rest he gave to his mother and to the four mothers of his seven children. Within a year, he was broke again. And yet, he insisted, I couldn't be happier. To understand Zuniga's resilience, you need to know more about Costa Rica, where an alchemy of geography and social policies has created a powerful blend of family bonds, universal health care, faith, lasting peace, equality, and a quality that Zuniga possesses in spades, generosity. This all culminates in an especially rich recipe for an enjoying life day by day, the pleasure strand of happiness. Here, this combination, all statistically associated with well-being, delivers more happiness per GDP dollar than just about anywhere else. Consider Zuniga's situation. Although he has no car, no expensive jewelry, no fine clothes or big electronics, he doesn't need any of these things for happiness or a sense of self-esteem. He lives in a country that for most of the past century has believed in supporting every citizen. Unlike most of Central America, where land barons and the military-backed presidents who served their interests dominated after independence, Costa Rica took a different path. With rugged, ravine-etched mountain ranges and a lack of cheap indigenous labor, conditions there discouraged the rise of large haciendas. Instead, small property owners and independent-minded Central Valley farmers thrived after discovering an international market for coffee. Costa Ricans elected teachers as presidents, who, unencumbered by corrosive colonial institutions, introduced policies that launched an upward spiral of well-being and thus the environment for the Latin American character to thrive. In 1869, Costa Rican law made primary school mandatory for every child, including, notably, girls. By 1930, the literacy rate was among the highest in Latin America. At the same time, the nation invested in supplying clean water for rural villages, stemming deadly childhood illnesses such as cholera and diarrhea, and ensuring that children's lives got off to a healthy start. The 1940s brought the beginnings of Social Security and an end to the army. By 1961 came legislation on universal health care, leading to free primary care clinics in most villages. And that commitment continues today. On a crisp winter morning not long ago, I followed a medical technician named Ileana Alvarez Chavez as she toted a backpack and a small cooler of vaccines on her rounds through the leafy Central Valley town of Paraiso. She works with EBAIS, the national system that was set up in the mid-1990s to support the health of every Costa Rican. Health and happiness are inextricably linked. Small teams, including a doctor, a nurse, a record keeper, and several technicians, are assigned the care of about 3,500 people. Alvarez Chavez's quota called for her to visit as many as a dozen homes a day. At each one, she'd spend 30 minutes to update medical histories, take blood pressures, give vaccinations, dispense advice, and check for standing water, where Zika virus-bearing mosquitoes breed. At the Hernandez-Torres home, Alvarez Chavez counseled a young mother on a healthy diet for her 2-year-old son and left behind vitamins and antiparasitic pills. As she walked through the house, she noted the white bread and milk on the kitchen table. "Try to eat more beans, fruits, and vegetables," she advised. At the home of 89-year-old Aurora Brenes, Alvarez Chavez inventoried medicines, took blood pressure readings, and set up an appointment for Brenes with her team's doctor. "I can often catch diseases before they erupt into full-blown diabetes or a heart attack," she said. "Many of my clients are lonely, and they just appreciate someone who cares." Since 1970, Costa Rica has seen life expectancy jump from 66 years to 80 years, and infant mortality drop by a factor of 7. The death rates from heart disease for men is about a third less than that in the United States, even though Costa Rica spends one-tenth as much per capita on health care as the United States. As former President José María Figueres, who implemented the EBAIS program, told me, "The nation's healthcare system works so well because it aims to keep people healthy in the first place. In the U.S., incentives are aligned to drive up costs," he said. "Here, for years, the emphasis has been on the preventive health system because, quite frankly, the objective of a good health policy is for people not to get sick. In short, Costa Rica's social system takes care of most people's needs, said Mariano Rojas, a Costa Rican economist and happiness expert at the Latin American Faculty of Social Sciences in Mexico City. It leaves them feeling safe, comparatively healthy, free of most of life's biggest worries, while providing an environment where most people can still make a living. In similar ways, Denmark supports the well-being of people like Sidsy Clemensen. I met her on my third trip to Denmark to explore that nation's unique brand of happiness, one that seems to enable people to live a purposeful life better than anywhere else. Sitting in her kitchen, sipping tea, the 35-year-old working mother with short brown hair wore a sleeveless blouse, Moroccan slippers, and a diamond stud in her nose. "The state provides me with everything I need," Clemensen said. "My children are happy, I have a great husband, and I love my job. I know that nothing too bad can happen to me." Clemensen and her family are one of 22 households in a shared housing community called a Bufalus Cab in the city of Aalborg. Each family owns a small Lego-like house, but together they share a huge garden, laundry room, workshop, storage area, parking facility, and dining hall where they can opt in to communal meals. Each family cooks one or two meals a month for the whole community and then eats the rest of its meals free. Perched on a low hill overlooking rolling pastures, the complex is within biking distance of the neighborhood elementary school and the university. In Scandinavian fashion, the co-housing complex offers an elegant mix of private and public, an apt metaphor for Danish society as a whole, with its emphasis on trust and community. Denmark's societal evolution may be traced to the Second Schleswig War in 1864, said Peter Gundelach, a sociologist at the University of Copenhagen, when Denmark lost a quarter of its territory to Prussia. "With that defeat, we lost our ambition to be a world superpower," he said. "It humbled us. Our government began to strengthen our national identity and build inwardly instead." Danes grow up believing they have the right to health care, education, and a financial safety net. University students draw a government stipend in addition to free tuition. New parents can take a year-long government-paid parental leave at nearly full salary. This includes gay and lesbian parents. People work hard in Denmark, but on average less than 40 hours a week, with at least 4 weeks of vacation a year. The price for such lavish benefits is one of the world's highest income tax rates, which starts at 41% and tops out at 56%, a field leveler that makes it possible for a garbage man to earn more than a doctor. Danish happiness is closely tied to their notion of trygged, which is spelled T-R-Y-G-H-E-D, the snuggled, tucked-in feeling that begins with a mother's love and extends to the relationship Danes have with their government, said Jonathan Schwartz, an American anthropologist based in Copenhagen. The system doesn't so much ensure happiness as it keeps people from doing what will make them unhappy. Setting aside time for self-fulfillment is another key ingredient of Danish happiness. More than 90% of Danes belong to a club or an association, from cold water swimmers to rabbit breeders, and more than 40% volunteer for civic groups. Danish society, it seems, encourages the kind of balance between engaging work and rewarding play that results in a sense of time described as flow. The Danes seem more aware of the total needs of a person than most other places, said Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, a psychologist at Claremont Graduate University in California. People need to be challenged. It's in our genes. We develop self-confidence through adversity. They're the building blocks to happiness. Singapore has developed its own approach to happiness, as personified by Douglas Foo. I first met Foo when I visited Singapore in 2008. He had a reputation for being hugely successful, community-minded, consummately principled, and irrepressibly affable. But his clearest expression of happiness I discovered was neither his expensive sports car nor his trophy case of business awards. It was his laugh, a wide-mouthed, back-tilted howl of joy. Fu runs Sakae Sushi, Singapore's largest chain of quick-service sushi restaurants, but he still finds time to volunteer for 22 organizations. During his 14-hour workdays, he wears tailored blue suits and presides over a dozen meetings with a mix of earnest ceremony, careful consideration, baritone decisiveness, and pandemic humor. His gift for diffusing tension with spontaneous laughter, coupled with a Herculean work capacity, has earned him all the trappings of Singaporean success. And while Fu will tell you he's happy, he still feels he hasn't yet arrived. "In the scope of things, I'm just an insect," he said with a grave expression on his round face. Then, realizing his own hyperbole, he cracked up. Fu, 48, is at an age that straddles the desperate-to-survive generation that founded Singapore in the 1960s and the 20-somethings who will marshal in a new future. In just over half a century, the 30-mile-long nation has transformed itself from a large fishing village into a country of 5.8 million people living amid thousands of high-rises and more than 150 shopping malls, a metropolis graced by tidy tree-lined streets. Success for Singaporeans lies at the end of a well-defined path. Follow the rules, get into the right school, land the right job, and happiness is yours. It's traditionally summed up as the 5 C's: car, condominium, cash, credit card, and club membership. In a system that aspires to be a meritocracy, talent and performance are rewarded in theory. You'll hear Singaporeans complain about rising prices and their overworked lives, but almost all of them say they feel safe and trust one another. The architect of this social experiment was the late Lee Kuan Yew, who led Singapore's independence movement in 1965. Overwhelmingly loved by Singaporeans, he famously endorsed strict laws and corporal punishment for violent crimes. With a keen appreciation for traditional Asian values, Lee set out to build a society based on harmony, respect, and hard work. Anyone who made an effort to work, no matter how lowly the job, was guaranteed a livable wage. His workfare program supplemented low salaries with housing and healthcare subsidies. Although the population is largely composed of Chinese, 74.3%, Malays, 13.4%, and Indians, 9.1%, Lee's government retained English as a lingua franca to help ensure no ethnicity would have the upper hand. He guaranteed religious freedom and equal education for all, and he subsidized home ownership. Most Singaporeans own a flat in government-developed housing, usually a high-rise unit. By law, such buildings must reflect the ethnic diversity of the country, so Singapore has no racial or ethnic ghettos. As a result, the people of Singapore today exemplify the third strand of happiness, what experts call life satisfaction. You score high when you're living your values and are proud of what you've accomplished. You tend to be financially secure, have a high degree of status, and feel a sense of belonging. To achieve this type of happiness can take years, and it often comes at the expense of enjoying moment-to-moment daily pleasures. Singapore's story, like those of Costa Rica and Denmark, illustrates how a relatively small, about 6 million people, prosperous nation can achieve a high level of well-being when guided by enlightened leaders. And yet, what works for such societies might not easily translate into solutions for a sprawling, diverse, argumentative, freedom-loving nation like the United States. Could such a tumultuous place, with its racial, ethnic, religious, economic, and political diversity, learn anything useful from Denmark's wealthy, relatively homogeneous, consensus-seeking social democracy? Likewise, could the United States really emulate the day-to-day joy of Costa Rica, or the values-driven security of Singapore? There's reason to think so, if a community like Boulder, Colorado is any indication. If Americans want to feel more joy in their lives, pursue their purpose more rewardingly, and find greater satisfaction in achieving their goals, they could listen to the citizens of Boulder talk about how to shape their community to support rather than hinder their collective happiness. Indeed, since the U.S. isn't one of the top 10 happiest places, it might do well to look to local bright spots to inform national policy. That's what I learned from Ruth Wright, an 88-year-old citizen activist, one chilly spring afternoon as we strolled down Pearl Street, the city's main pedestrian mall. It was 2 o'clock on a workday, and a hard mountain sun was beating down on the brick pavement. Men in puffy down coat jackets huddled in conversation, dreadlocked students tapped on computers, and only a few people in office-friendly plaids seemed to be moving with any destination in mind. Decades ago, when the city council decided to allow high-rise buildings downtown that would have interfered with the mountain view, Wright led a successful campaign to ensure no building would cut Boulderites off from nature. It was the beginning of a career of questioning the unquestioned virtue of development. Her public service led her to the state legislature, where she represented much of Boulder for 14 years. As we passed through the historic section of downtown, Wright frowned at a new glass and brick structure, occupied by eco-chic outdoor clothing boutiques and organic foodie emporiums, whose presence she found jarring. "My life's work has been in preserving that," she said, pointing to where the pine-dotted Rocky Mountains towered majestically over the rooftops. As stunning as the setting is, Boulder's appeal is more than just skin deep. Besides being a college town, an adventure destination, and a haven for elite athletes, it produces the highest level of well-being for its residents. People there live better lives than residents of any other city for which we have results, said Dan Witters, a research director at Gallup. Witters created the Gallup National Geographic Index, designed to assess 18 of the most important indicators of well-being. His analysis included obesity rates, absence of pain, feelings of safety and security, whether people use their strengths and accomplish their goals, and whether they learn something interesting daily. Even included dentist visits, which counterintuitively perhaps are strongly associated with happiness. Among 190 U.S. metropolitan areas, Boulder came out on top. And that is where we are going to have to leave this article, which came from, we only had a little bit left to read, and it came from a book, Blue Zones Happiness, written by Dan Buettner, and he is a New York Times best-selling author, and he's been exploring what makes us healthy and happy for the past 15 years. So I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body today. Stay happy, well, and come back next week for more healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.